This is Robert Greeno. This is Robert Greeno. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal. Thank you very much for joining us for another edition of Midrats. We are live today, so if you would like, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find our chat room that we keep active during the course of the show. And if you have some observations you'd like to share as we go forward, or even some questions you would like for us to address to our guest, that's a great place to put it. We'll be standing by, and we'll see you there if you are so inclined. And if you have to take off and leave at some point during the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, if you don't already, remember to go ahead and subscribe at iTunes or Spreaker or whichever podcast aggregator you get. If you would like, the show will be waiting there for you. And you can also catch up on some previous shows that you may have missed. But today we're going to go ahead and just dive right into the show. And for the last 20 years and even a little more, there's been a lot of attention to unmanned systems. Most of it has been in the air. But inside the navalist community, a lot of us have been paying attention on the developments that are taking place both on the surface and under the surface, whether you're looking at small mine hunting vessels or even large unmanned surface vessels that could have a variety of use for the force ability. And we have a lot of great professionals out here who that is their job. And today what we want to do is we want to talk about that part of our Navy that's developing unmanned systems on the surface and under the seas to do a variety of missions. We're going to talk about some of the platforms that are already displacing water or traveling the oceans, some concepts that are coming up and the fleet's going to experiment with soon, and also some of the challenges that they have in the community as they try to make this work. And our guest for the full hour could arguably be the best person to talk about this. Our guest is going to be Captain Pete Small, United States Navy. He is the Program Manager for Unmanned Maritime Systems, otherwise known as PMS 406, inside PEO Unmanned and Small Combatants. Captain Small, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here. Pleasure.
We really appreciate your time to take an hour because It may be hard to describe how interesting this is to a lot of people who, you know, we usually like to have stuff on here that interests people for national security and maritime reasons, but I don't know whether it has to do with science fiction or just the mechanics of it all, but even outside the naval interest, and you talk about unmanned systems, you get a lot of people that are very interesting and interested in the topic. And when I put out the analysis for the show, I had a couple people reach out to me who described you as either the most overworked or the most powerful O6 in the Navy. You know, where do you see yourself in that spectrum?
I'm certainly not the most powerful, it seems like, on a lot of days. There's definitely plenty of work. There's definitely plenty of work to be done. When I took the job, I told my wife that I had gotten the best job in the Navy and that I would need her to remind me of that periodically along the way. And I do need her to do that, and she does. But it is really a tremendously exciting place to be at the forefront of a new evolving technology that's going to change the way the Navy fights. And so there's really no better seat to be in than mine, I think. Again, some days I wish it wasn't so attractive and it didn't attract so much attention, but it is a great job and it's a great effort that's going on.
Well, I can appreciate that feeling. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. Go ahead. You have a thought you're going to finish. I'll let you do that. It's live radio.
Dave, I pop
live radio.
At any time. that's understandable. All the attention because you're a submariner by trade, and everybody likes the silent surface. You like to go do your stuff and come back and nod the head and go forward. But you're now in the engineering. You're now an engineering duty officer. And a prior guest we've had on the show, Mark Vandroff, who used to be on the surface side working the DDG 51 program, we had some real fun shows with him. And part of it is, in the back of my mind, I think that the Navy, as part of their officer recruiting, they really could do worse than finding a way to describe what the engineering duty officer community does in the Navy. Because if you're a young man or woman who likes to build things, likes to run things, likes to put things together, ask a bunch of smart people, can you make this happen? If so, what does it take? It really is a unique area that does a lot of neat stuff years before anybody else sees it. I just want to give you a chance before we dive into some of the details is talk a little bit about the unmanned maritime systems, your team, and things that y'all are running and working with.
Okay, great. Thanks, Sal. And thanks for the shout out to the engineering duty officer community. It's very small by the overall makeup of the Navy officer force, and we do have some key positions in leading a bunch of both development and sustainment activities across the Navy domains of, you know, surface, undersea, space, weapon systems. So it really is a great career path to choose from in terms of responsibility and program management and working with industry and government teams across a broad spectrum of really important efforts. Me, you referenced, you know, my background. I started in the submarine community and stayed through a junior officer tour and shore duty, and then I transitioned into this community. And since then, I've spent most of my career working submarine acquisition programs, both Virginia program at the start of really kind of early construction in the Virginia program, and then again later on in the first ship of the Block 3 class of submarines, and a couple tours in the Columbia program office early on, really before there even was a program office as we stood it up, and it was then referred to as the Ohio Replacement Program Office, and again later on as the first construction manager as we got into early, you know, pre-official start, early prototyping and fabrication to ring out the newly restarted missile compartment production facilities, and a host of other undersea systems program offices and other things. But all that experience has been great to position me to what I'm trying to do now, which is stand up a host of efforts across both the surface and the undersea domains. So you asked about, you know, where I am and what I do. You did mention, so I'm the major program manager of NAVC PMS 406, which is our office code unmanned maritime systems in PEO unmanned and small combatants. Just a little note of history on that PEO or program executive office for those who aren't familiar with the Navy's acquisition structure. A PEO, or Program Executive Office, is a collection of program management offices that are acquiring systems, usually with some collective association like submarines or surface ships. So PEO USC has had a little bit of an interesting history. It was really born out of PEO Littoral and Mine Warfare a number of years ago. And so that's really where a lot of the roots of our unmanned efforts are in mine countermeasures and mine warfare. And so there are efforts in the PEO that date back to PEO LMW, it was referred to. And then as time went on, it was renamed PEO Littoral Combat Ship. And that was to reflect what was going on at the time where the Navy organized the Littoral Combat Ship Acquisition Program, which had a number of separate program offices, one for the C frames, one for the mission modules, and then some of the other components all together in a single PEO called PEO Littoral Combat Ship. And so, again, some of those unmanned mine warfare systems became part of the Littoral Combat Ship Mine Countermeasure Mission Package effort. And specifically, those are the what was called the UIS or Unmanned Influence Sweep System, which was an aluminum unmanned surface vessel that towed a influence sweeping cable to sweep acoustic and magnetic mines, and then a UUV called Knifefish, which is a very specialized unmanned underwater vehicle that has a very, again, specialized host of sonar systems for detecting bottom and buried stealthy mines. So those are part of the LCS Mine Countermeasure Mission Package. That was all in PEO LCS. And then back in 2018, the PEO was renamed again PEO from PEO LCS to PEO Unmanned and Small Combatants. And that was a reflection of the developing scope of the PEO beyond just the Littoral Combat Ship packages, both in the small combatant realm with the addition of the Frigate Program Office, which is a new and exciting and important program for the Navy, which is also in PEO USC, and also a program office that is doing foreign military sales of a small surface combatant derived from one of the Littoral Combat Ship variants. So there's multiple surface ship small combatant program offices, and then there was also increasing unmanned efforts, primarily in my portfolio that I'll get to here in a minute, PMS 406. So again, 2018 renamed PEO Unmanned and Small Combatants. So from a program office perspective, PMS 406, a quick history on that. In 2000, so that kind of evolved out of, again, the Littoral Mine Warfare, Mine Countermeasures efforts with Knifefish and a few other things. And there's changes over the years, but I'll say the kind of current version of where we are today started in 2016 when there was a consolidation of unmanned underwater vehicle efforts that had been going on kind of around the Navy in a variety of places. The OPNAV resource sponsor consolidated those in one program office that was PMS 406, and we still had those aspects of the LCS Mine Countermeasure Mission Package. And then over the next couple years, there was an increase in the number and scope of unmanned underwater vehicle programs, including some that we'll probably talk about here later on, called Snakehead Large Displacement UUV and Orca Extra Large UUV. Those programs started to take off, and so there was a growth in our efforts. And then most recently, since really 2019-2020 timeframe, there's been a very large and rapid expansion of efforts in larger unmanned surface vessels that are resourced by the Director of Surface Warfare on the CNO staff, and those are particularly medium USV and large USV that, again, we'll touch back on later on. So really in 2020 was kind of where we peaked, I'll say, in that all of those things, a big chunk of the UUV portfolio, medium and large USVs, and the Littoral Combat Ship Mine Countermeasure Mission Package were all in under our umbrella. And then so much so that we actually, a number of things have happened over the last year organizationally in PEO USC with respect to unmanned, the first of which is that we transitioned the LCS mission package efforts, both the UIS or the sweep system I described earlier, which had also grown into a larger program called Mine Countermeasures Mission Package, or Mine Countermeasures USV, I'm sorry, that also added a towed sonar hunting payload to the sweep capability. But we moved both MCM USV and the Knifefish program over from PMS 406 to the overall mission package program office called PMS 420, or the Mission Modules Program Office. And that was a result of two things. The first and most important of which was we in 406 had gotten those two programs through Milestone C. So those two programs, MCM-USV and Knifefish, are ACAT-2 DoD 5000 programs of record, and we had gotten them through their individual developments past Milestone C, which is a very important programmatic milestone, and into low-rate production. And then the next step for those systems was to do mission package level testing on board the LCS. And so it made sense to transition those efforts over to the overall mission package program office, who was in charge of all of the testing associated with LCS mission packages. And it freed up some important bandwidth in PMS 406 that we were needing as a result of the growth of the unmanned surface warfare portfolio and autonomy in general. So then before I wrap this part up, the last, I'll say, organizational thing that happened in the past year was that two existing program offices that had not been under the umbrella of PEO-USC as part of a separate Navy organizational restructuring came into the PEO, and that is PMS 406 for expeditionary missions. They procure a host of equipment for explosive ordnance disposal teams in the Navy. So they are also doing expeditionary mine countermeasures and procuring UUVs. And then the other program office that came in was called PMS 340, or Naval Special Warfare Missions. And again, they support Naval Special Warfare teams in buying a host of equipment and weapon systems, including UUVs again. So what you have now, kind of in the current state in the PEO, is four program offices doing unmanned efforts, not just 406. So we're still a leader and play a significant leadership role both in the PEO and in the Navy kind of overall for unmanned efforts, because that's all we do in PMS 406. But there's also the Mission Modules Program Office with their two systems, expeditionary missions with UUVs for expeditionary mine countermeasures companies, and PMS 340 for their naval special warfare. And so there's a ton, I mean, we do a ton of collaboration in the PEO and across the Navy writ large, but now with those four program offices working closely together in the PEO, there's a ton of synergy there. So that's kind of a history of where we were. The current state is my portfolio includes a range, what we call family of UUVs, primarily a medium UUV for submarine integration called the Razorback, large displacement UUV, again, for submarine launch and recovery called Snakehead, and extra large UUV called Orca. And then on the surface warfare side, medium USV, large USV, and some prototyping programs that are serving both of those, namely Sea Hunter and her sister ship Seahawk are now part of my portfolio, and a growing fleet of prototypes called Overlord unmanned surface vessels that has been started by the Strategic Capabilities Office and is transitioning and growing in PMS 406. And then finally, supporting both of those portfolios are R&D lines for core technology enablers, things like autonomy, command and control, energy systems, ship integration, that are also funded and run out of PMS 406. So a bit of a long answer, but hopefully helped fill in some of the history of where we are and how we got here.
Yeah. You had an article back in 2019 in the Undersea Warfare magazine, and you mentioned in there the National Defense Strategy, which said that America can't hope to prevail in the future conflict using yesterday's weapons or equipment. And having looked at some of the programs you've got and some of the prototypes you've been running, including the, I want to call them offshore oil field vessels that you're using to prototype the large surface unmanned, is it vessel or vehicle? I call it vessel because I'm a Navy guy. And you know, I'm thinking, well, somebody is saying, and I guess you answered this briefly, somebody is telling you we need an asset that does this. We want an asset that does this. Who is doing that to direct your energies in this area? Does that come out of the CNO side, the surface warfare people, or where exactly that come from?
Yep. So, we talk sometimes or pretty regularly in the office about experimentation versus prototyping, and we can go down that path. But we are really prototyping platforms and solutions against, I'll say, early requirements being developed by the CNO staff in the warfighting domains that are resourcing those requirements. So we call them top-level requirements, but the director of undersea warfare or OPNAV N97 on the CNO staff is writing requirements for unmanned undersea systems, and then our prototyping efforts and programs are a result of those. And again, they're not all in the same stage. Some of them are more formal. KnifeFish, as mentioned, is a formal program with CDD level, JROC approved requirements. Others are earlier, like Orca and Snakehead, and we have what are called top-level requirements, and we're doing prototyping to validate those requirements and demonstrate and de-risk the technology before we transition those programs into formal programs of record with hard requirements, I'll say. And so similar situation on the surface side, where the director of surface warfare on the CNO staff, or OPNAV N96, is writing top-level requirements for medium and large USV. Interestingly, on that note, medium and large USV are part of what's called the Future Surface Combatant Force Architecture. So there is, in fact, an ICD, a formal JROC-approved ICD for the Future Surface Combatant Force. That is the result of an analysis of alternatives that was done back in 2018 for that same force-level AOA. Not just a platform-level AOA. So that AOA identified four surface platforms as part of the Future Surface Combatant Force. One is a large surface combatant, which today is, your DDG, Flight 3, the most advanced DDG. A small surface combatant, which today is LCS, soon will be frigate, and there's even talk of a follow-on to that eventually. And then the two other platforms were the large unmanned surface vessel and the medium unmanned surface vehicle. So those are somewhat formally identified in that AOA and ICD, and now we are prototyping efforts to develop those systems against top-level requirements that the N96 has written for medium and large USV. For the most part, we are working on solutions to stated problems, and we can go into what, each one of those things, whether it's on the UUV side or the USV side, has intended mission set that it's going after. They're all intended to be modular in terms of payloads and autonomy and future capabilities, but they all have a first mission set identified against something that has already been identified as a specific need supporting the undersea and surface domains. We can talk more if you want to also about the, you mentioned how I mentioned the National Defense Strategy. I'll just mention that since 2018 and a lot recently in the last 2 years, we now have a pretty complete set of strategic documentation that lays out the why and the need for unmanned systems with, the Tri-Service Maritime Strategy that was released in December of 2020, clearly lays out the need for a hybrid fleet of manned and unmanned systems and the need to increase the capacity of that fleet and distribute our forces in that new fleet. And then after that came out the CNO's NAV plan, which was essentially his implementation of the Tri-Service Maritime Strategy that calls out the capabilities that we need, including unmanned platforms to operate inside our adversary's missile defense zone. Capacity, again, a call for capacity that the Navy needs to get larger and more distributed and more lethal. And then even Since that, the Department of Navy released the unmanned campaign framework in March of this year that was one more level down and holistically focused on the full spectrum of unmanned capabilities, including, you know, doctrine, organization, training, policy, facilities, and try to put a finer point on why we need the systems, where are we now, and how are we going to get there. So I feel like, you know, we get accused of not really telling a story, and a lot of that is valid and deserved, but we've also done a pretty thorough job in the last several years in writing that story and tying it back to that national defense strategy and really trying to get after some specific mission sets and capabilities with increased levels of realistic prototyping, which is the stuff we're working on right now.
I mean, since our nautical ancestors grabbed an old boat, set it sail, lit a bunch of pitch on fire on top of piles of old hemp rope. I mean, there have been unmanned systems used in naval warfare for a couple thousand years, I guess. But, you know, technology grows and change, needs and priorities, new ideas and concept popped up. And what are the technology or other changes that have taken place in the last couple of decades that's driving either the capabilities or the desire to expand into more unmanned systems?
So, the underlying all of this really is computing power and the power of digital systems. Autonomy is at the core of unmanned. You know, unmanned is an adjective that describes a platform that we put out there. The things that allow it to operate effectively and reliably as an unmanned system are a number of things, at the root of which, though, is autonomy. And so the ability of the digital systems to run the autonomy code and take the information from a sensor suite and the situational awareness that comes from the combination of advanced sensors, advanced computing, and then the autonomy code that's taking that information in and then acting, doing something with it, all wrapped in a wrapper that has to be enduring and reliable. And so that ties in energy and overall mission reliability. So all of that wrapped up is what gives you an unmanned capability. But I think really what's allowing us to move forward now is first the demand signal, right? So we haven't really been focused on the current threat, you know, kind of since 2018, the National Defense Strategy, the pacing threat has come into view. And if you read those documents that I mentioned earlier, each one of them describes how the threat has changed, right? Near peer competitors, great power competition, but the technology available is changing the way that we're going to fight. It's going to change the way that our adversaries fight. And by definition of the need and the changing face of warfare, we then must respond to also adapt our warfare systems to take advantage of that technology to meet the threat, but also to, again, grow our size and distributed fleet in meeting that threat also. So it's really the driving threat, the use of the technology from the threat, and then the availability of computing power and autonomy that's really driving us to move towards unmanned systems. I think, you know, if we don't, we'll be left behind.
One of the concerns I've seen from Congress is that they are having the Navy having kind of bad experiences with certain previous shipbuilding and aircraft programs, not to mention you know, they're a little jaded about the approach to this, and I guess they have some concerns about making sure that what we're going to get into in the future is something that works together and cooperates. And part of that has to do with the command and control system that's available. And if you can you discuss, to the extent you can, the level of command and communication that gives us some comfort that we if we dispatch one of these unmanned units someplace, we're going to get it back, or it'll do what it's supposed to do when it gets there, or we can communicate with it?
Yeah, sure. So I could take that one in a number of different directions. But first, you know, addressing the congressional concerns, you know, you mentioned at the very beginning of the show, you know, if I'm the most powerful, or I forget the other one you said, but I guess if I had a nickel for every time I've been approached by a congressional staffer about the Littoral Combat Ship program, the DDG 1000 program, or Ford elevators is my recent most favorite one to get compared to, I would certainly be a much higher paid 06 than I am right now, because I hear those stories all the time. And, you know, there's plenty of merit and for those criticisms, and certainly we need to be good stewards of the taxpayer money and not relearn a bunch of hard lessons that we don't have to. So there's definitely good feedback that we take out of those conversations. But at the same time, it is a new technology, and we do need to prototype, and we are going to have to you know, try things out. And people like to talk about, you know, failing fast and everything else, but our system really isn't set up to tolerate failing fast. And so we have to find this balance between prototyping a new technology with purpose. I mean, those strategy documents, especially the CNO's materials, highlight the urgency, and that speed is important. So I'm constantly in balancing of trying to go fast because there's a demand and we want to get this technology out there and people are calling for it, but also then offset by the need to be responsible and not, you know, not be the next Ford elevator story. So we're definitely having to balance those things. I got off topic, and now I'm trying to remember what the original question was.
Had to do with the comm systems that,
oh,
that
yeah,
we can
C2,
have.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. The other thing, you know, the other thing we get compared to are unmanned aviation systems, or UAS, that are certainly, you know, decades by some measures ahead of us in the surface and undersea domain. And by the nature of certainly the undersea domain, connectivity is only sporadic. And so we are definitely reliant upon autonomy in the undersea domain in a ways that we haven't had to be initially reliant on autonomy in the aviation domain, with generally assumed real-time and constant connectivity. And then the surface domain is somewhere in the middle, where we don't intend to really remotely pilot unmanned surface vessels or unmanned underwater vessels at any point. We're from the beginning relying upon a certain level of autonomy to do the essential navigation and piloting of those vessels. So from that aspect, we are already, you know, that's part of the requirement set for the initial prototype vehicles, is that they're essentially sensing their surroundings and navigating themselves per some pre-programmed in mission. That's part of that initial command and control sequence. And then there is sometimes sparse or intermittent supervisory oversight of those unmanned systems. And again, it's driven by the domain and the connectivity that's provided either in the surface or undersea domain. So we are working on those systems to provide that connectivity, and there's a host of challenges, but one of which certainly is just the number of different systems. So one of the things we're trying our best to get right from the beginning is to provide a common command and control interface across the domains and across these multiple systems, such that we will have an easier, I didn't say easy, but a easier job to provide interoperability across the systems themselves and the domains, and to reduce the burden on the Navy sailor operators who will be providing that oversight, whether those are sailors on a DDG employing command and control of other unmanned surface vessels, or either on a submarine or in a shore-based command center doing command and control of an unmanned platform. So we're trying to provide that common interface to reduce the training, integration burden, and the interoperability of those systems. There's an important international aspect of this, too, in that we certainly want to be interoperable with our partner nations and their unmanned systems. So we're it's a tall task, but we're working hard to ensure we can be interoperable across domains within the Navy and interoperable with other allied partners, both manned and unmanned assets. So there's a particular program we call called Common Control System that is essentially just a software interface, and so we're working to standardize that. That's just the software interface, though. Those command and control signals that are sent from that software interface need to get to the vehicles to and from the control stations on established networks and secure and reliable networks. And that's another technology area that we're working on. Again, different in the surface and undersea domain. But there's a lot of great capability out there that's provided already from our manned forces, both surface and undersea. And so we're not trying to recreate the wheel here for these unmanned systems. We are trying to integrate these unmanned systems into those networks by which we communicate between our manned platforms and provide that command and control and that autonomy supervision across those networks. And then, we need the unmanned systems to be interoperable with the manned surface ships and the manned submarines that are out there today. We can't create our own separate networks and solutions for unmanned systems that we then have to integrate into the ships. That'll never work. So, but there's certainly a lot of emphasis on those networks lately and appropriately in talks of the Naval Operational Architecture and Project Overmatch. And certainly the intentions there are to exploit that secure and resilient set of communications paths to employ that more distributed and larger hybrid fleet and be sharing information in a powerful way that allow us to meet those threats. So it's a lot of work. Again, going back to the beginning, you said I was perhaps the most overworked 06, but there's a lot of work to keep up with that and work to ensure that our unmanned systems that we're developing, the platforms themselves, and the command and control systems will integrate into that naval operational architecture that people are working hard on.
I kind of laughed when you were talking about being assaulted by various groups of scattering hill rats wanting to talk about LCS, DDG 1000, and the Ford elevators. And I'm sure you've been approached by this as well, but especially in the course of the last 18 months or so when the topic of large unmanned surface vehicle come up, have people say, well, you know, by mid-decade we should have, you know, big unmanned systems with tons of VLS cells. I'm like, whoa, hold your horses there, Buck Rogers. I don't know how fast those things can move. And, you know, we talk about what we're actually doing with them. You got to be careful we don't fall accidentally into, you know, things behind the cipher door, so to speak. But on the civilian side of the house, I think it's really interesting what you could already see going on. For instance, a regular reader of mine, Sid, sent me a link before the show. Over in Lake Michigan, they have drone sailboats that are basically mod-locked in a couple of parts of Lake Michigan doing long-term fish surveys that they use as a way to determine what the commercial catch will be allowed. It's basically a fisheries intelligence operation that's, you know, real unmanned systems doing real missions out there collecting real intelligence. And is it a correct assumption if you look kind of like, Wayne Myers' crawl, walk, run construct, that when we're looking at how these systems that you and your team are working on, we may see practical applications or additional practical applications going forward, that on that spectrum of intelligence gathering, whether it's whatever area of intelligence you want to do it, above or below the water, through some interim steps, then there might be some ordnance downrange applications take place. You know, where do you see some of the milestones in the spectrum of capability that people should look at, whether we're talking about fleet experiments going on later on this decade or in the following decade actually showing up to deploy?
Good point. And certainly I talk to a lot of industry folks who have really powerful and pretty mature unmanned system capability out there. And to do, essentially persistent data collection. So I would say that technology is here today. And as you point out, it's in use. And from an intelligence perspective, I'll say, it's probably, it is in use, and I probably don't know about it. We probably don't know about it either. But, that technology is here. It's in use, and I'd say that's pretty mature. And that's a good point to make. But there are other, the mission sets that are driven by warfighting scenarios that are referenced at a high level in the strategy documents are going beyond intelligence gathering. And the CNO plainly talks about increased capacity and depth of our missile magazines and increased lethality. So it's right and proper to talk about crawl, walk, run and using smaller systems for intelligence gathering. But it's probably not right either to wait to get after the larger payloads, the military payloads that are clearly part of the threat that we see right now today. And so, there are classified studies and things going on about warfighting scenarios and mission effectiveness of different platforms and mixes of different platforms. And, those have shown pretty clearly, again, in classified setting, the utility of the large USV with the increased missile magazines overall in theater, but also the more distributed missile magazines in theater and the power that brings and the effectiveness of that against very demanding threats in the Western Pacific. So, we surely don't do a great job of talking about all of that. Some of it's classified, but we do need to get after the larger payloads, the lethal payloads, because that's really what we're going to need in that future fight. And that harkens into a question that I get all the time also, like why are you starting with large stuff, extra large UUV, large USV? Why don't you start with smaller stuff? And some of the answer to that is, well, we are starting with smaller stuff. There's plenty of that going around. We can cite you the examples. But the demand, again, is driven by warfighting scenarios far overseas in Westpac, and small systems don't have the range or the payload capacity to get into the fight unless they're brought in there by some other manned platform that is going to bring that manned platform into the threat area inside the missile defenses of our adversaries. And they're also not going to have the endurance to stay on station or have the payload capacity to bring militarily useful payloads, whether they're kinetic or not kinetic. So a real reason why we want to get after large things is because the threat and the warfighting mission that is driving us requires us to be far forward, on station for a long time, and carry militarily effective payloads that are not really risk reduced by some of these earlier persistent kind of small sailboat type systems, which are really interesting and powerful and effective in what they do, but they're not doing some of those things that we're working on.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting at the Sea and Air Symposium, wherever it was that you talked at Sea Airspace 2021 Symposium. You talked about the large unmanned surface vessel, and it was designed to carry a vertical launch system. But you also mentioned during that because it can't do everything, it can't refuel itself, it may be necessary at times to have people on board to help carry out some of those jobs that can't be done by machines at the present time. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit? And is that a short-term project? I'm reminded as I say this that back in the 1920s when they were building those cruisers and stuff that kind of testing out new concepts, the concept was build a little, test a lot. And I have the feeling we're still in that phase with a lot of these programs. So in light of that, can you go back and talk about the manned aspect of this now and how long you envision that happening?
Yeah, so we're certainly working on both the CONOPS of operating, unmanned platforms in concert with our manned platforms, but then also figuring out what is the role of the operator with an unmanned platform. And so we have prototypes on two ends of the spectrum. The Sea Hunter prototypes I mentioned earlier are truly unmanned systems. In fact, the original Sea Hunter had no accommodation for any humans, and they had to add a pilot house just so that they could get it to and from the pier and transfer the people off and then put it in autonomy. But they're really not designed for any accommodations at all. And our medium USV that we're working on the requirements for and doing some prototype for are more intended to be truly unmanned, in that, again, just getting them underway from the pier and then transferring the people off and switching over to autonomy operations is their primary mode. And so we're certainly trying to figure that out. And the Overlord prototypes that we're working on that you mentioned earlier, which are converted fast supply vessels that were designed to service the oil rigs, they still have accommodations for a crew, and we're operating them essentially as optionally manned at this point, where we still have people on board when we operate them in autonomy mode. And we do that supervision from on board. So we're directly taking in the operations of the vehicle when it's in autonomy mode. And so we're working on figuring out what is the role of the human and how close does that supervisory oversight have to be to the platform. And then, ties up also back to the development of that C2 interface and the networks and the level of information and connectivity we have. So all that is wrapped up together. But on the large USV, we certainly have seen the need to have people on board at certain times for a variety of reasons, and one of which is just to de-risk the autonomy technology in these early stages. So our first concepts of large USV include accommodations for people on board. And now those people aren't intended to be driving the platform really at all is our intent. We do intend the platform to do that autonomous navigation and mission execution that I described earlier. But we may need those people on board to do things like refueling. We may need them on board for anchoring. We may want them on board for force protection or things that we just haven't figured out how to unman yet. Things like, radios and crypto gear. Some of you guys have Navy experience and may have, understand how you have to reload crypto periodically in the secure radios. That's a technology. There's 100 things like that we just have to take the operator out of the loop to have truly long duration unmanned operations that we're working on, but we may need, you know, we recognize that all of that may need not get done, or there may be one thing or another that we just haven't sorted out yet, and we want to have the ability to have people on board. So we're working that in to the large USV from the beginning. And there's an interesting philosophical fight that goes on around that, because there's a whole group of people that say, you know, if you have one accommodation on board, the whole concept is blown and it gets too expensive, and the, you know, you don't truly believe in unmanned systems. But then there are others on the more pragmatic side of that scale that say, yeah, that's really hard to get to that truly unmanned stage, and you may want an operator on board for one thing or another for the near future anyway. So it's just kind of a snapshot of some of the things we're working on.
Yeah, I think the ongoing battle between the pragmatists and the zealots, it's an important battle, though, and I'm, you know, I'm glad to hear that you're having that with the discussions of risk and everything else, because we can spot all sorts of programs, whether it's surface-based or in the air, or that died an early death because the pragmatists lost a couple of arguments, and then when it was time to make shadows on the ramp or displace water, physics and reality creeped in and made it no longer viable, which was sad, because there are interim steps you can take that you can really leverage some of those advances. And speaking of advances, on a lot of topics, one thing I like to ask our guests, because it's really easy when you're in the U.S. Navy and how much larger we are in almost every measure to our allies and friends, that we can lose sight of what they do. You mentioned early on in the show about ensuring that we had interoperability with our allied nations. And we have some of our allied nations, some who are rather small, 5.5 million people in Denmark, for instance, that have some pretty interesting systems in a variety of areas. Are there some of the things in autonomous systems or unmanned systems that our allies are working on do you find really interesting or would like to steal?
Well, there's certainly interesting things, and a lot people are interested in unmanned. Other nations and partner nations are interested in unmanned for a lot of the same reasons we are. So there's commonality there. There's some people who have some pretty robust MCM or mine countermeasures capabilities. So I think that's one area where there's certainly parity or other very capable systems that are being procured and put to use in terms of mine countermeasures. So we have some specific requirements in that ours are hosted on board the littoral combat ship, and there's two variants, and that, you know, creates integration requirements and things that make our solutions somewhat unique. But the physics of finding, identifying, you know, localizing and neutralizing mines in the water column is a common problem, and so our allies have some good capability there. So those things are interesting. But then certainly just perhaps more important than the specific vehicles or platforms or mission sets they're going after is the interoperability. And the whole point of that naval operational architecture and Project Overmatch is to be able to share information, no matter what sensor node it's coming from. And so the thought with increased numbers of distributed unmanned systems, whether they're the United States systems or an allied system, is that we want the information that's available from those sensors such that we can act upon it and use it to our advantage in the future fight. So I think really what we're more interested than just buying their systems or doing what they're doing is to be able to share information between each other and put that to use for the joint force against the near peer threat. So interoperability and information sharing is really the of prime importance. And just, you know, at a pragmatic level too, there's not a, you know, none of us are really in mass production of quantities of these things. So we're kind of similar in that regards in terms of maturity.
Yeah, speaking of maturity, I mean, I find this fascinating. This is like science fiction to me, but I was reading an article about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months ago about C-Train, and DARPA is trying to develop a way to increase the endurance or the range of the USVs. Can you, do they talk to you about that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. And one of the things that we work very hard to do is stay connected to the technology developers. I mean, and going back to the beginning of the show, 406 and PEO USC, we don't consider ourselves to be the technology developers. We're trying to take the technology that's ready and field it in numbers to meet the demand that I outlined, you know, from the beginning. We're an acquisition program office. Our job is not to advance the state of technology. Our job is to, you know, mass produce it and hand it over to the sailors to go fight wars with. To that end, we stay very closely connected with the technology developers at ONR and DARPA and the Strategic Capabilities Office and industry to assess the state of that and then also become a transition partner. So we are, you know, there's a couple, when one or more of those technologies proves to be promising and needs the transition across the well-documented valley of death into a program of record, you know, we have specific funding identified to do that, and we work with the Navy staff and the requirements people to identify which ones of those technologies do we want to resource and transition into the program. So we pay close attention to those. And then NOMARS is one we are tracking. I mean, as I described earlier, all of these unmanned surface vessels and unmanned undersea vessels need to get across the Pacific Ocean and into the fight. And that means something else is going to carry them over there, or they're going to get there on their own legs. And C-Train is just specifically intended to help reduce the energy requirement to transit across the ocean by ganging surface vessels together and reducing the wave-making drag and just really solving the problem of getting to the fight and then having, you know, the energy resources and everything else to remain on station and do your job. But that is an interesting technology, and we're working closely with them. The other thing I'll mention in terms of the autonomy developers themselves, though, so we're assessing all of that from a receiving position, but we are also sending out to those technology developers the standardization efforts that we are working on as a Navy. I hinted at one earlier, the Common Control System. There's a bunch of people working on different systems, but we want it to be fielded to interoperability, as I described. We need to have some standards, and so we are in the business of writing standards for command and control and CCS, but also in the autonomy code with a standard we've developed now and called Unmanned Maritime Autonomy Architecture, autonomy code developers, so that we can integrate sensors and sonars and autonomy capability across platforms and across domains. And so we are sending those technology developers standards that we need to ensure future interoperability, so that as they are developing the code and the sensors and the capabilities that they're working on, they're already aligned to this, to a common set of standards that we will need to, again, reduce the work to integrate and field those things in numbers. So again, a little bit of a long answer, but we spend a lot of time coordinating with ONR, DARPA, and SCO and industry on those types of efforts.
Well, it's been a great hour, and again, I really appreciate you coming on to talk with us. I guess to wind things up, if a lot of our listeners wanted to keep track in a busy news cycle of the developments that are taking place in unmanned systems with our Navy, whether it's, you know, Overlord program and NOMAD, or whether Congress is going to come at your funding for the large unmanned surface vessel again, where's a good place or some good terms that people can keep an eye out for so they can keep abreast of these developments? Because this news cycle is going nowhere this decade when it comes to the Navy's expansion into unmanned systems.
Wow. Well, certainly we're large USV is always a good Google term because that one certainly generates lots of conversation with Congress and has dominated our dialogue. So that will probably still be a good thing. But, I mean, there are a number of efforts that, one of the things we're working on now is an offensive surface fires analysis of alternatives. So that is a little bit more analysis going on this year that will help refine and or validate the large USV requirement. So offensive surface fires is a term that's under study right now, and over the next year, the results of that will be completed and available that will help us refine that force structure and the solution set for getting after that missile capacity, whether it be LUSV as we envision it currently and described here today or some different variation of that. But that's an effort that's ongoing. Certainly we are really developing a growing fleet of unmanned surface vessel prototypes. So Sea Hunter and Sea Hawk, those two are on the West Coast with our Surf Devron partners in heavy rotation doing naval experimentation. We're going to transition the first two Overlord surface vessels. You mentioned Nomad and Ranger, her sister ship, from the OSD over to the Navy in my program office here at the end of this year. We're building two more of those. Hopefully, we're all fingers crossed as Hurricane Ida comes ashore. Tonight, we have two more Overlord unmanned surface vessels in construction on the Gulf Coast that will deliver next year that will add to our growing fleet of prototypes. And then we also have one medium USV prototype. So we're going to have seven unmanned surface vessel prototypes delivered and in heavy rotation by 2023. And even now, with the addition of all of those extra prototypes, we are doing a lot more experimentation with Navy experimentation and technology demonstration. So I think you're going to hear us in a careful and measured way, because we do have to be careful and measured because our adversaries are paying attention and trying to steal our technology. So we're always cognizant of that. But you're going to hear us talking about this fleet of seven unmanned surface vessels doing more and more capability demonstrations of more and more mature operations and CONOPs that are really going to hopefully start filling in some of the questions, at least by showing where the opportunity is. We're still going to have a lot of hard questions to go answer, but until we get those prototypes out there in operations and could put our money where our mouth is, it's just kind of our word against their word, whoever they are in this scenario. And so we're hoping to, again, put our money where our mouth is by showing that this technology is close and, ready to get fielded with some more development and investment of time and resources, and capable in that, we're going to show some pretty unique capabilities that can be deployed from these systems. And the same goes on the undersea side. When we get a Snakehead large displacement UUV in the water at the end of this year, delivering Orca XL UUV prototypes and start showing off what they can do. So in the next year or so, you'll just hopefully hear more of us talking about what we are doing and not just about what we hope to do. And that'll keep this dialogue going and hopefully in a positive manner. I will say, we didn't talk about the budget much, but it is a challenging times from an overall Navy budget perspective to defend the resources required to continue this investment in unmanned technology when there's so many other big bills to pay and important shipbuilding efforts that have high priority in the Navy. So stay tuned to all that. I don't think the conversation will die down anytime soon.
Well, let me say that I'm glad you came on today and talked to us, because it's a really interesting topic, and I think we've just scratched the surface. And for those of us who did the dull, dirty, and dangerous work without UUVs or USVs, I think this is something that I'm sure the fleet is looking forward to, have these units come online as soon as they can.
Yeah, there is. We do get, we have a big demand signal. That's one of the things we're not fighting. Again, I'm a little surprised we didn't get to talking about, the analogies to nuclear power and Aegis and all those things. But we are not fighting manned operators who don't want this stuff. We're quite the opposite. The combatant commanders, the fleet commanders, they're all calling for this capability. They see the threat in their backyard. They want the capability that unmanned systems can bring, and they are part of the demand signal saying, send us this stuff. We want it, and we want it fast. So that is a problem that we I guess you could see it as a problem that they want it fast, but at least we're not having to fight the cultural shift against the unmanned capabilities. The fleet really wants the stuff.
It's a good problem to have. It's always good to be loved, and we loved having you on today, and we'll be keeping an eye on you, because nobody's going to get bored at work, and I don't think we're going to get bored taking this. So hope you have a great rest of the summer, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk to you at some point down the road.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me on. I enjoyed our conversation, and I'm always happy to find new and interesting forums to talk about the Navy's efforts and promote the Navy's efforts for unmanned, because I think it's really important. So thank you for inviting me and providing this opportunity.
Glad to have you, and thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.